So we're on Daf Tzadi Omid Beis. Tana Rabbanon, which is three lines up from the bottom. Tana Rabbanon, Ein Motzi'in Peros Me Eretz Yisrael, which literally means, we'll have to see why, one is prohibited from removing produce from Eretz Yisrael, taking it to Chutz Laretz. And the Braisa qualifies this. What does it mean? It reminds me of, you know, coming into an airport from another country and they check your bags, they ask you if you have any food. It's Dvarim Sheyesh Bahem Chaye Nefesh. These are things that are necessary for support, for life support. Kigon. And the Braisa gives three examples, one of which I understand, the other two a little bit more challenging. Yenos Shmonim Uslosos. Now slosos, which is solus in plural, is fine flour. And obviously flour is necessary for bread, to make bread. So that's certainly a staple of life. Wine and oil, perhaps a little bit less so, but also necessary items.
Wine especially.
What do you say?
Wine especially.
Wine especially, yeah. So these are items that are basic, and we need them in Eretz Yisrael, and we don't want to take them to Chutz Laretz because that'll deplete the supply in Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira Matir B'Yayin. He disagrees with Tanna Kamma, and he holds that as far as wine is concerned, we don't mind depleting the supply of wine in Eretz Yisrael. He's not in favor of flooding the market with too much wine, because that's going to bring down the price of wine and that's going to make it very accessible for everybody to buy wine. And he doesn't want too many people drinking wine. He says the less wine in the land of Israel, the less tifla, the less indecency. Chazal say about wine, Mishenichnas Yain Yotza Sod, that, you know, wine puts a person in a certain mood. The Gemara in Sota says that Haroa Sota Bil Kukula Yazir Atzman Ayahi, because sometimes people get together, they start drinking intoxicating beverages, and I would assume schnapps is included here, then it creates a certain kind of atmosphere of indecency. And therefore, Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira is okay. He doesn't mind, he doesn't object to the fact that we reduce the drinking of wine, which will therefore reduce improper behavior and desire. It's like you spoke about yesterday when you talked about the man is also Ofer Min Adam, you know, it brings him down to earth. So Yayin could bring a person down to earth.
Yeah.
You know, we have Noach and his case of Yayin and what that happened. We'll have Lot with Yayin and so forth. Then the Braisa continues and says, "Ukishem she'ein motzi'in me eretz lechutz laretz, kach ein motzi'in me eretz Yisrael leSuria." That this prohibition of taking oil or wine or flour outside the land of Israel, not to deplete Israel of these basics, applies even if you're just crossing the border from Eretz Yisrael to Syria. Now Syria, which shares the northern border of Israel, has certain dinim of Eretz Yisrael. For example, with regard to mitzvos hatzlius ba'aretz, Chazal defined Syria, because it's somach l'Eretz Yisrael, as an extension of Eretz Yisrael. But nevertheless, the Braisa insists that it still remains chutz laretz, although mirabbanan it has certain dinim of kedushas Eretz Yisrael. But nevertheless, it is chutz laretz. And therefore, once we say that you're not allowed to take basics, and with regard to flour, that's kuli almalo, there's no debate about it, we're not allowed to take the flour and export it to Chutzlars, that applies even to Surya. The Rebbe Matir. But Rebbe allows taking flour, for example, in this case, to Surya. Now, there's a long discussion here about the status of Surya. Our assumption is, before we saw Rebbe, that Surya is certainly Chutzlaretz. Rebbe, on the other hand, allows export to Surya. Could be that he holds what's called Kibush Yachid Shmei Kibush. What that means is that David HaMelech conquered areas of Surya and expanded the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael to include Surya in the north, not necessarily through the laws of Kibush Rabim, which means that he went to the Sanhedrin Agdola and he conferred with the Urim Vitumim in order to allow fighting this battle to expand the boundaries. Could be that parts of Eretz Yisrael were not yet conquered. Why was he conquering Surya? That becomes Kibush Yochid, which means an individual kind of conquest. And the question is whether Halacha recognizes individual conquest as an extension of the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael, which would mean that perhaps this Tana that allows you to take these basic staples to Chutzlaretz, he holds that Surya is not Chutzlaretz. It has the din even on a Doraisa level of Eretz Yisrael because Kibush Yochid Shmei Kibush. Anyway, that's a sugya in two places. Number one, in Masechta Gittin on Daf Ches, and also in Avodah Zorah Daf Chaf. Okay. Now, it could very well be that when it says that Rebbe is Matir, and here we're going to turn to Daf Tzadi Aleph Amud Aleph, he didn't make a blanket statement that you're allowed to take all these basic commodities all over Surya. I mean, Surya actually comprises a large area of land.
Is that today Syria? Is it the same country?
So there's a long footnote here in the art scroll. I don't have it here in the Masifta. Ah. And he talks about the fact that Surya, I'll just read it to you, he comprises large areas of land, some of which is today Surya. He talks about Aram Narayim, which is to the east of Nahar Prat. He talks about Aram Tsova, which is in the north and west of Naram Prat, in the area of Aleppo, that's called Chalab today. And he goes on and on in terms of this expansive area. But if you take a look here on Daf Tzadi Aleph, Amud Aleph, which is really our Daf for today, the Brisa circumscribes the Heter of Rebbe. And it says, Meherpachya liherpachya. And what that means is the following. Herpachya is the Aramaic counter, or counterpart, yeah, of Pelach. Okay? Now, the word, that's what Rashi says back at the beginning of this Masechta. Now, Pelach, according to the Sefer HaAruch, who is one of the Gaonim, he says that any cluster of six cities in a small radius, that means they're very near each other, is called a Pelach. I guess in English you'd call it a district. And what's happening here is that you have a city in Eretz Yisrael, which is within the borders of Eretz Yisrael, on the northern tip of Eretz Yisrael. Let's say today it might be Metula, in the modern state of Israel, and there are a cluster of cities across the border, which is technically, legally called Surya, but since it's within the same Pelach, therefore it's considered part of Eretz Yisrael, at least as far as the jurisdiction over Eretz Yisrael is concerned. So it's quite possible that this Hiparchia, which is this cluster of cities on the border of Eretz Yisrael, was under the jurisdiction of the land of Israel, and Jews settled there, and therefore Rebbe allows you to take and deplete Eretz Yisrael of its basic staple commodities in those areas that are on the border of Eretz Yisrael. Okay. Now we get to what I would consider the main sugya for today. I'm just going to make a bracha here. Bracha to Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam shehakol nehiyeh bedvaro.
Amen.
Now, before we start the new sugya, I want to mention here a unique sheet of the Rambam. The Rambam is in Perek Yudal in Hilchas Mechira. The Meiri here agrees with the Rambam that what the Gemara means here when it says Mehirpachya Lirpachya is Mirshus Melech Zeh Lirshus Melech Acher Shebe'eretz Yisrael Atzmo. Now let me explain to what's going on here. The Rambam has a radically different shot in our sugya. According to the Rambam, the land of Israel itself was divided into various provinces, each of which came under the jurisdiction of a different king. So I guess you would say legally, these different provinces within Eretz Yisrael were, so to speak, different governmental bodies that controlled and dominated this land. So the sovereign rulership within Eretz Yisrael was divided up into different kings. And the Chachamim, the Tanakam of this Braisa, prohibits taking flour, for example, as a staple, from one province within Eretz Yisrael to another province of, within Eretz Yisrael, because they come under two different jurisdictions, two different kings. Whereas Revi says that we treat Eretz Yisrael as one indivisible entity, and even the Prachya Leprachya, even though there may be different jurisdictions, we're permitted to take flour from one province to another province within the bounds of Eretz Yisrael. In which case the Rambam is against the Rashbam, because the Rashbam understands that the Chiddush of Rebbe here was to allow you to take flour to Chutz Laretz, to a different district, which is in Syria, as long as it was within the same Pelach, as we discussed. That's the Rashbam. According to the Rambam, Rebbe never allowed the export of flour from Eretz Yisrael to Syria, no way, no how. What Rebbe was making, he was more lenient within Eretz Yisrael, from one province to the other, even though they come with different sovereign rulerships. And the Rambam says that the Tanakam of this Braisa is of the opinion that within Eretz Yisrael itself, there was a prohibition. Each province is required to maintain the availability of these basic staples within the province itself, and therefore export from one province to the other within the bounds of Eretz Yisrael, according to the Tanakhama, is prohibited.
What is the reason? Would there be shortage? Or
there would be a shortage.
Now, was there big shortages in those days?
Well, in the case of Shemen, it seems that there wasn't such a big shortage, because if you take a look back here on Daf Tzadi Amud Beis, so it says over here, just one second. It says Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra Matir B'Yayin. He was Makil in Yayin. And the reason for that is because he wanted there to be a limited supply of Yayin. And we're going to soon see that Rabbi Yehuda was Matir even B'Shemen. So that, I think, is going to answer Brian's question, but maybe we're jumping the gun just by two lines of Gemara. And sometimes if I lose the flow of the Gemara,
sorry.
No, don't. Yeah. No, you're right, but I just want to see the next. Tana Rabbanan. Ein mistakrim b'eretz Yisrael b'dvarim sheyesh bahem chaye nefesh. Once again, the Bryce is focused on staples. And the goal of this brisa, of this halacha codified therein, is to reduce the price, the market price of staples. Because obviously, bless you, very, very consistent, maybe a little bit early. But we have to worry now not only about the supply of these staples in Eretz Yisrael, but also a decent price. Because if things get too out of control and the price starts soaring, then your average middle class Jew, and how much more so low class Jews that have limited finances, will not be able to afford buying staples. And even today, when you talk about poverty in the world, which in underdeveloped countries you're talking about billions of people who are starving, they don't have bread to eat. So bread is the staff of life. And we have to guarantee that the price of flour on the market, for example, is decent. So what do? The problem is that you have, let's say, the balabais. The balabais is growing wheat in his local, you know, he has his little backyard farm. He now sells massive, you know, significant quantities of wheat to a middleman, and that middleman is going to jack up the prices, right? Because he wants to make a profit. Correct. So this brisa is trying to block that practice, which was apparently very common, and there's nothing illegal about it, in order to guarantee Kigon, Yenos, Shmonim, U, Slossos, again, flour, wine, and oil, that the prices will be very decent. By knocking out the Socher, who's the middleman, who's going to buy from the farmer and sell in the marketplace. And therefore, what this Brisa is requiring is that the Balabais himself, who produces and harvests his wheat, he will personally take the wheat to the marketplace, and that will guarantee that the price is rugil. Rugil means a decent price. Now, the Rashbam points out that if the middleman would purchase quantities of wheat and then grind them and convert them into flour, in such a case, it's mutter. We're okay with the middleman. And even though he's going to make a profit, and that's going to jack up the price of the flour, that profit is perfectly justified by the fact that he's putting in an effort, a tircha, and he should be compensated for that tircha. So that's seen as a public service in the fact that he's doing something beneficial for the people to buy flour, because otherwise if you buy wheat, it's a tircha gedola to convert it into flour. Amru olav al Rabbi Lozar ben Azaria, one of the great Tanoim, shahaya mistaker b'yayin v'shemen, that he himself would purchase from the balabatim who produced the grapes and harvested the olives, and he would sell it on the market at a profit. So the question is, why does Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah disagree? And the answer is going to be the following: that as far as Yayin is concerned, he holds like Rabbi Yehuda on the previous Amud, that Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra was of the opinion that we want to minimize the amount of wine in the market. So if the price of wine goes up, who cares? On the contrary, that's good, because we aren't too much drinking wine. Again, the whiskey people in our shul are going to be very upset about this, but that's what it says here, according to Rabbi Loz ben Azariah. Sada Rabba, the halacha has vested interest in jacking up the price of wine. And with regard to oil, the Mefarshim say that there was such an abundance of oil in Eretz Yisrael, and this is true even today, you can buy Israeli oil, Sheven Zayit Zach, such that even if we add the middleman into the equation, it would not jack up the prices to be ridiculously high, and they wouldn't skyrocket. That's what we have here in explaining Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah. So the Gemara says, "B'yayin savrala k'Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra," and therefore we want to minimize the amount of wine that's being consumed, and b'shemen, because "B'asrei Rabbi Eliezer ben Azariah shchiach mishcha," there was a large quantity available in the shuk of oil, and therefore the price of oil had a natural built-in control mechanism because of the volume on the market. That's what we call the law of supply, supply and demand. So the supply of oil was so great in that area that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah felt that it was mutter to do schora and add this extra price to jack up the price, the market value of shemen. And the Ad Ramah here adds that it's not just shemen, but it applies to any produce that's matzui biyoser, the supply of which is great. So again, the Gemara explicitly mentions oil, but it goes beyond oil. Now, what about eggs? You know, today we live in a society where, you know, people buy eggs on a regular basis. I mean, there are people who eat eggs daily. And again, there are issues here about cholesterol. I'm not getting into that. Back in the day, eggs were kind of rare. Not like they are today. Tana Rabbanan, Ein mistakrim pa'amayim bebeitzim. Now, what does this mean? The Gemara offers two interpretations. Literally, it means there's no, you know, we can't add another middleman into this sale, because again, that's going to jack up the prices of eggs.
It becomes a black market.
Omar Murray Bar Murray. It's very interesting how his name came about, Murray Bar Murray. Okay, that's not for us now. Pligi ba Rav Shmuel. There are two interpretations of the story of eggs. Rav and Shmuel. Chad Amar, according to one opinion, Al Chad Trey, which means the following: that if a certain volume of eggs sells on the market for one dinar, he's not allowed to double the price and charge two dinarim, making a profit of 100%, meaning 200% all told. Now the implication is that anything less than shnei dinarim, if it's a drop less than that, let's say he would only make a profit of 49%, that would be permissible. So the Rashbam here has a problem, because the Gemara Daf Tzadi on the previous daf quotes Shmuel. And Shmuel's principle is that when I want to make a profit by selling something, the maximum profit is 1/6. Because beyond 1/6 of the market value, I violate the Iser Onah, which means cheating by overcharging. Here, apparently, in the case of eggs, the shita of either Rav or Shmuel, whatever it is to be lenient and allow you up to, but the ceiling is 50% of a profit, but up to 50% of a profit. Now 49% is a lot more than 1/6. So apparently, the shita here of this brisa is to be makil to a special leniency with regard to eggs. And the Rashbam explains, because eggs are not a staple, to some extent they're considered a luxury item, again, back in the day. I wonder how the halacha, the poskim, would deal with this today in our contemporary society. And not only that, the egg sellers were generally poor people who would go from place to place trying to find the egg farmers in order to gather together the eggs and bring them back to the smaller locations and sell them to the consumer. This required a tremendous amount of tircha. And therefore, even though the general rule for produce is you can make a maximum profit of 1/6, they were more lenient in the case of eggs, allowing for these poor people to make a profit of 49%, but not beyond, not to 50%. And that would give them a way of living, an income. And also because it's not a staple, that's why they were making. So this Gemara, this price, according to this interpretation, is a kula for eggs as opposed to other produce. However, Tosfos quotes the Rashba. This is not the Rashba from Sfarad, but the Rashba from Ashkenaz. And he says, no, that what's going on here is the price is being machmir, is being more strict in the case of eggs, because the law is that when Shmuel gave us the ceiling of making a profit up to 1/6 and not beyond, he was talking not about things that I make homemade in my own house, but things that I buy and sell in order to make a profit. The maximum is up to jack up the price by 1/6 to make that profit. However, the Rashba, quoted by Tosus, says that Dvarim Shenasim Bebeso, like for example, back in the day, you would have a woman who would weave garments and sell them on the market. There's no limit halakhically to how much profit she's allowed to make, because that's not something that's considered public marketable stuff that's sold in the market, but rather it's privately made. Now, in the case of eggs, we're talking about, says the Rashba, Tarnagola Shebebeso. He's got his own local hen who's producing, giving birth to eggs, and therefore the halacha should allow that any price that he wants to charge for his Tarnagola Shebebeitzim, he's allowed to charge. But the chumra was that even in such a case of homemade stuff that's being sold on the market, the maximum amount of profit is 50%. Now, there's a Tosefta here which I think would support Tosus in the name of the Rashba, because the Tosefta applies this halach of up to but not beyond 50% profit to peros, which means to produce, which means it's not limited to the case of eggs. Now, if you go with the first pshat, that this is a special kula in eggs because of the tircha, that the ani goes around, and also eggs are not considered a staple, it's a luxury item, why should that be expanded according to Tosefta, that kula, even to peros? But if you go with the second pshat, then we could talk about a person who's growing fruits in his backyard, so to speak. He has his own lemon tree and he wants to market his lemons. And the chumra is that even though, generally speaking, that which you market from your backyard, you're allowed to charge, the sky's the limit, but up to, but not beyond, 50%. That's one interpretation of this price. And then the Gemara, back to the Gemara, says, V'chan omar tagor litagra. What the Brisa is telling us is that although you can have one middleman in the case of eggs, because eggs is not considered a staple, but a second middleman, meaning that Reuven is marketing his eggs, Shimon buys the eggs, sells it to Levi, and Levi's the one who jacks up the... So you have two people in the middle, both of whom are jacking up the price to make a profit, and then the price of the eggs is going to skyrocket. That's not allowed. So the word pamayim, according to the second interpretation, has nothing to do with the percentage of profit, but pamayim means how many middlemen there are who are making a profit. And again, all this is because there are very few merchants who are selling eggs, and we don't want, because there's so few merchants, we don't want the price of eggs to skyrocket, and therefore one merchant in the middle, one middleman is allowed, but not two. Now, Rabosai, what happens when a certain commodity, and the Jewish people in Israel are making business and supporting their families with that by selling that commodity? For example, in Israel, oil and wine are a very great commodity. All of a sudden, for market reasons unbeknown to us, the price goes down. It depreciates very radically. This becomes a dangerous situation. The Levush, who lived about 5 centuries ago, he calls this pikuach nefesh, because people are not going to be able to support their families if all of a sudden there's a tremendous dip in the prices of these basic staples that are being sold by the average person in Israel to make a profit. Is Tana Rabbanan, in such a case, masriim al prakmatia, if this merchandise goes down, masriyim. Now, what does the word masriyim mean? There are two interpretations of the word masriyim, and they're both offered by the Gemara in Tainus on Daf Yudalit. According to Rabbi Yehuda, the word masriyim means to blow the shofar. Now, when they blew the shofar publicly, that was a sign that we were crying out to God. And Rav says the masriyim means tzokim b'kol gadol, and they recite Anenu, Anenu biyom tzom tanisenu, we're in a tzara gedola. And the Gemara says in the name of this brisa that if the prices of these things go down, then masriim, we're required to either blow the shofar or cry out in Anenu, v'afilu b'Shabbos, even on the Shabbos itself. Now, Shabbos is a day of Simcha. On Shabbos, we don't usually cry out. But the Levush says that since this is a Pikuach Nefesh situation, people won't be able to support their families. Therefore, Pikuach Nefesh is Docha Shabbos. The Maratz Chayis has a different shot over here. He thinks that Shabbos is a Shas Rachamim. And if the Shaar, the heavenly gate of mercy is open, we have to take advantage of that even on Shabbos. And then the Muki Yosef goes on to say that this heter is only for davening. It's not for blowing shofar. We don't blow shofar on Shabbos under any circumstance. Omer Rabbi Yochanan, Kigon, let's give examples of prakmati, of merchandise that was so basic to the market in Israel. Klei Pishton. Oh, now interesting. Rabbi Yochanan was in Eretz Yisrael, but he traveled back and forth to Bavel, and there was a tremendous, that's why we have the Talmud Bavli, a tremendous center of Jewish life in Bavel. So the statement here of Rabbi Yochanan addresses Bavel. In Bavel, the Jews made a profit from what we call today Shmatas. Okay? Klei Pishton b'Bavel. Okay? They sold linen garments, and that's how the Jews made a living. So in New York, there's something called the Garment District. Back in the day, it was 99% Jewish. Today, the Syrian Jews in New York are making the profit from Shmatas. But whatever it is, this goes back to the time of Bavel, almost 2,000 years ago. And Yain v'shemen be'eretz Yisrael. And the people were making a profit in Israel by selling wine and oil. And here the Rashbam wants to understand, but wait a minute, if the price dips, that's good for the poor people. But he says that in the overall picture, when we weigh on the balance, the detriment to the average Jew who's making a parnasi and he has to, the rank and file citizen in Israel, and we weigh that against the ani who's going to have to pay a normal price if God answers our prayers and the price, goes back to what it was, then we have to get the price back to what it was. Otherwise, the people of Israel are going to literally starve. Omer Rav Yosef, Vehu Dizol Vekom Asara Beshita. At what point do we say that the price of these garments, let's say, has dipped so low that we were in an emergency situation, we're going to allow praying on Shabbos? That's when something which normally goes for 10 is being sold for 6. Which means that you can only get 60% of its value, and a 40% dip or depreciation in the market value is enough to justify this special head. Okay. Now we get, in honor of the doc's arrival, to the main sugya for today. Okay then? This is the main sugya for today, and the doc decided that he would be mechavin the shah, I see. Very well. Tana Rabbanan ein yotzim me'eretz l'chutzlar. One is forbidden from leaving the land of Israel to go to Chutz Laaretz. Now again, if you're going to Kruger Park, for a week, that's okay. But we're talking about people who want to settle in Chutz Laaretz. And the Rashbam says that by doing so, he's mafkia es atzmo mi mitzvos hatluyos ba'aretz. He's removing himself from these great mitzvahs, which he can fulfill only in the land. The Ramban, in his commentary on Parashas Masai, at the end of Sefer Bamidbar, says that there's a mitzvah to live in Eretz Yisrael, and it's counted in the Taryag. In fact, in the Ramban's critique of the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvahs, he accuses the Rambam of omitting the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael. And the Ramban proves from the Pasuk of Yishavtim Bo that there's a biblical command to live and dwell in the land. And this person wants to leave the land. The Gemara says, in the name of this Braisa, that there's only one situation which will justify leaving Eretz Yisrael, and that is El Im Kein Amdu Sasayim Bisela, which means that normally the price for 2 seahs worth of wheat is a half a seah. Now it went up to a full seah, which means it doubled in price. And that, of course, as a result of supply and demand, means that there's a very low supply of wheat in Eretz Yisrael. We call that a drought year. And as a result of the severity of this drought, the Tanakhama, we'll soon see the Reb Shimon disagrees. Again, we don't know exactly who this Reb Shimon is, but Reb Shimon is going to disagree. The Tanakhama holds that in such a drought year, then you can pack your bags. There's no mitzvah to starve in Israel, and you're allowed to move to Chutz Laaretz because the normal price has been doubled. That's the Tanakhama.
So that's, you can leave Israel, as we learned, if you need to get a parnosa.
Correct, but at what point is the parnosa so severe, the challenge is so great that you're allowed to, you can't just say, well, you know what, I'll make another 20% of my profit because I'm going to be, you know, I'll get a job in a hospital in Chutz Laaretz. No, it's got to be such that the prices of the staples of life have doubled. Then and only then you're allowed to leave. Amar Rav Shimon, Rav Shimon disagrees. And what does he say? He says the following. Amosai, when are you allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael? Bizman she'ein motze likach. That there is no availability of wheat. Aval bizman she'motze likach. If there is wheat to be found, afilu omda sa bisela lo yetze. Even if the price of wheat jumped up to a sa bisela, which is a tremendous amount of money to pay for wheat, but nevertheless there's wheat available, lo yetze, he's not allowed to leave Chutz Laaretz. Eretz Yisrael to Chutz Laaretz. And the Mariel Diskin wants to say that im omda sa biyoser misela, if we get to the point where it's even more than a sela, then even Rav Shimon would allow because of this yoker gadol. Now, there's a Tosfos here, Dibra Maschil Amosai. And Tosfos says, Tema, I don't understand. Im eino motzi likach, if you're talking about that there's no availability of wheat, is afilu elef sa besela. Even if you'd have to pay, even if it was elef sa besela, meaning if you could get for one sela 1,000 sa, mayasa, if there's nothing to be had, it's not available in the marketplace, you should be allowed to leave. So here the Lecha Mishnah, in order to try to explain and answer Tosa's question, he says, "Ein kavanas haGemara she'eno yochel liknos klal." The answer to Tosa's question is that the Gemara doesn't mean that there's no wheat available, but rather there are two factors here. Number one, yihisyakru, it went up tremendously in price, and number two, gam kosher liknosam. The availability is very limited, and therefore, if you combine both of these factors, then and only then does Rav Shimon allow you to leave Eretz Yisrael. V'chein, hoy Rav Shimon ben Yochai Omer, that's why we don't know who the first Rav Shimon is, because usually Rav Shimon is Rav Shimon bar Yochai. He says that to prove this point, that you're not allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael, even in a drought year, and the price is now doubled, Sharei, because I'll prove it to you, if we can close the door, it'd be great. Elimelech, umachlon vikilion, gdolei adar hayu, ufarnasei adar hayu, umipnei ma nenshu. You may remember that Elimelech, machlon and kilion, in Megillus Rus Perek Aleph, when there was a drought in Eretz Yisrael, they packed their bags, they went to Moab, and there Elimelech dies, Machlon dies, and Kilion dies. And after their death, Naomi, the widow of Elimelech, comes back to Eretz Yisrael with her daughter-in-law Rus. She becomes a Gioress, she marries Boaz, and the grandchild of that marriage is going to be David HaMelech. But in any event, why is it that these people who are both Gidolei Hadar and Parnasei Hadar, what does that mean? Gidolei Hadar and Parnasei Hadar. Number one, it means that they were people on such a high level that they didn't deserve punishment. And number two, the Dar, the generation depended upon them for their wisdom. They were Parnasei Hadar, they would supply the Dar with wisdom and with guidance. Nevertheless, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, din is din, judgment is judgment. There's no masli panim here. And they perished. And why is it Menesha Yatsu me Eretz l'chutz laretz? Because they left from Eretz Yisrael to Chutz Laretz. Later on Daf Tzadi Aleph Amid Beis, we might not get to it today, Rabbi Shu ben Karcha disagrees, and he says that the reason why they were punished is because they didn't pray enough on behalf of the people. Now the next word in the Gemara is very questionable. Shenemar. Now, if you have the Girsa Shenemar, the Marsha wants to take it out, the Shenemar indicates that I'm going to prove this point, that you're not allowed to leave Eretz Yisrael, from the following Pasuk. And that's very difficult, because the Gemara at this point seems to be discussing an entirely different, on a totally different topic, another aspect of Megillas Rus. The Pasuk there says that when Naomi and Rus come back from Moab to Eretz Yisrael, it says Vatahom kol ha'ir aleihem. Now what does that mean, Vatahom kol ha'ir aleihem? There are three different interpretations of this word Vatahom. There's some stir going on over here. Vatomarna hazos Naomi, and they said, is this Naomi, or this is Naomi? My, what does it mean, hazos Naomi? The Marshal points out that sometimes you can darshan a hey as a ches, which means it's chazos Naomi, we see Naomi. Chazos is miloshen chizoyon, to see. On Rabbi Yitzchak, chazisem, have you seen Naomi? Do you realize what's going on here? She yotzas meretz Yisrael l'chutz l'aretz. She left the land together with Elimelech. And ma also, what happened to Naomi? As a result of the fact that she left, she lost her husband and she lost her two sons, Machlon v'Kilion lo aleinu. The Marsha says over here that there is a possibility of justifying Shenemar, because according to this Girsa, Elimelech was a very rich person and he left Eretz Yisrael because the Aniyim, the poor people, were banging down his doors Yomam v'Laila to beg for Parnasa, and he was guilty, Elimelech, of Tzorus Ayin. He didn't want to give of his funds and be badgered by the Aniyim. But the Marsha quotes a Yalkut Shimoni and he says that the reason why they died, he says, just one second, Shemos ishto ubanov l'lamit shalo ikfu zed zem mitzaris ayun sha'omru kol b'nei ha'ir hazos ni'ami kloma ra'isem es na'ami ma'irula machmas shahaysa eineha tzara bi'orchim ba'anim. That she left Eretz Yisrael, that she also agreed to leave Eretz Yisrael because of Tzaras Ayin, and she was punished. Shemesu Baila Ubaneha. So it means that there's an element here of Tzaras Ayin in the guilt of Naomi, etc., of leaving Eretz Yisrael. But then he writes the following: Shenenshu Ilu hayu nisharim be'eretz Yisrael, had they remained in Eretz Yisrael, lo hayu mesim, they would have been protected by Eretz Yisrael. Umuchach mizeh, says the Marsha, sheyesh iser lotzeis l'chutz lotz, afilu kshatvua misyakeres, im yesh li adam atzmo de momen ketelus parnes bo. That if Elimelech could have, with his funds, even despite the drought and the expensive market price, he could have survived it in Eretz Yisrael, you're not allowed to leave. Because had they remained in Eretz Yisrael, they wouldn't have died. So what is Vatahom kol ha'ir aleihem? So according to this interpretation, which is offered by the Tosefta, and again, I'm trying to push in a lot in the last minute or two that we have here, is Vatahom kol ha'ir aleihem alamit shahayu kol anshei ha'ir kayamim. What the Gemara is trying to derive here is from the fact that the entire city was in an uproar, it means they all survived. When Naomi came back, the city was alive. Why did they survive the Ra'av? The answer is that despite the drought, they were in Eretz Yisrael and they were able to survive. But Elimelech, who packed out with Naomi and his two sons, Elimelech and Machlon and Kilion, they perished. So that there are different interpretations here of the word Vatam. And I found something very fascinating here in the footnotes. So the name of the Mitzvah is David. His name is Rav David Pardo. He writes that the reason why Naomi survived, why wasn't she punished? She was also a tzara be aniyim. He claims that a woman has a natural tendency built in that she wants to hoard things for her family, and she's always worried about the future, and therefore she's not so eager to spread the wealth because she needs that security, that nest egg as we call it. And therefore she wasn't as guilty as they were. They should have overcome that feeling of tzaras ayin, and they should have, well, again, according to other interpretations, they sort of have another element of care for the people, vatiyom kol ha'ir, and that's why they perished. Rabba Barafuna Marav Evtzon Zeboaz. In Shoftim, in Perek Yud Beis, there's a shofet by the name of Evtzon. And Rabbi Barakuna wants, this is important for him that we should know that this Evtzon is the same as Boaz. So Boaz in Megillus Rus is identical with Evtzon in Sefer Shoftim. Now, I have a long note here in which he tells us the Psukim in Perek Yud Beis of Shoftim, Vayishpod Yiftach es Yisrael, Sheishan Vayomis Yiftach Gilad, Vikambir Gilad, Vayishofet Achrav es Yisrael Avtzon mi Beis Lechem. So there was a certain Jew who was a judge by the name of Avtzon. He took over in the passing of Yiftach. He came from Beis Lechem, and he had 30 sons, the Pasuk says, and 30 daughters. And the Torah, the Tanakh, goes on to tell us that Vayishpod es Yisrael Sheva Shanim, he served as a judge of Israel for 7 years. Now Rashi in Shoftim works out the calculation that if Boaz, as we'll soon see, was the son of Nachshon ben Aminadav, he was the grandson of Nachshon ben Aminadav, then if that be the case, if he's the same as Evtzon, then at the time that he married Rus, he must have been, according to the calculations, Rashi goes through it, 300 years old. Now Avraham Avinu gave, you know, fathered a child at the age of 100. And the Torah makes a big deal about it. Why is there such a big deal made about Boaz if he was 300 years old, if he was Avtzon? And Rashi answers that since the Torah, the Tanakh in Rus, says, Vayiten Hashem lo hirayon, that she, Rus, was pregnant, God intervened, there was a divine miracle, that's where the miracle is indicated as far as Boaz as well. The Gemara wants to know, and why does Rabbi Barav Huna feel so compelled that it's critical that we know and that we recognize that Avtzon is Boaz? And what if we didn't know that? So the Gemara says that ki idach de Rabbi Barav Huna, this is going to be the basis for another statement of Rabbi Barav Huna, di Omar, Rabbi Barav Huna, Omar Rav, Me'avi Esr Mishtos Osa Boaz Lebonav. He had 60 children, and each one had an extra feast. And the Mefarshim say, why did he make two feasts for each one? So there are a whole bunch of different possibilities. The Gemara seems to indicate that he wanted to satisfy not only himself, but also his Mechutanim. But be that as it may, according to one interpretation, he made a feast when they were born, and each one of his 60, and then another feast when he married them off. According to some, he made one feast at the time of Erison, when he engaged them, it was a big engagement party, and another feast at the time of the Nisuin, when they actually went into the Chuppah. And even though after the Chuppah there were 7 days of Mishteh, each day requires a Seudah, but nevertheless it's called one Seudah of 7 days. Shenemar, and after the Psukim, Vayehilo shloshim bonim u'shloshim bonos shilach hachutza u'shloshim bonos hevi lebonav min hachutz. He married them off. Vayishpod Yisrael shevashonim, and this Evtzon judged the people for 7 years. That's what it says in the Psukim there in Tanakh, in Perek Yud Beis of Shoftim. V'chol achas v'achas osa shnei mishtos, Echad b'beis aviv, v'echad b'beis chamiv. You know, beis aviv here is the child's father, which is a reference to Evtzon himself, and beis chamiv is the father-in-law, meaning the father of the bride or the groom. U'bekulon lo zimein es manoach. But the sad story of it is that he never invited manoach. Manoach, who would later become the father of Shimshon HaGibor, and Manoach's wife was an Akara, she was sterile, as it says in Shoftim Perek Yud Gimel. And the Marshah is very bothered by this, because why would Evtzon, who is Boaz, not invite Manoach to all these parties? And the Gemara, in the name of Rav Huna Marav, gives an answer which is not satisfying. B'kulam lo zimein es Manoach. He didn't invite Manoach lefi. Why not? The Omer kudna akara, a mule, a sterile mule, b'may parley. How is he going to pay me back if I invite him to all these seudos? So the Marsha says, what's going on over here? We're talking about one of the Gedolei Ador, because Evtzon is Boaz. And how could it possibly be that Boaz would be guilty of such a crime that he wouldn't invite Manoach, because Manoach was a sterile mule? So the Marsha explains the actions of Boaz, and that is that whenever you came to a party of this sort of festival, Simcha, you brought a matana, you brought a gift, a drasha geshenk, it's called in Yiddish. And Boaz knew that he was on the recipient end, if he would invite Manoach over and over again, of these matanos, these gifts. And he didn't want to accept a gift gratis that he couldn't pay back. And here he wouldn't be able to pay back Manoach, because Manoach had no children. He was childless. But the Ben Yehoyada, well, first the Ein Yaakov offers another pshat, and he says that Manoach was an Amoretz, and this is a sugya regarding Rebbe, that Rebbe didn't want to support an Amoretz. Again, you have to know what an Amoretz was like. That sugya is the beginning of Baba Basra Daf Ches. And the Ben Yehoyada of Ben Ishchai says that Boaz was choshesh that Manoach, if he would invite him and he was an akar, would feel terribly depressed about the fact that he had no children and he was not making any parties. And then Rabbi Bar Rav continues by saying, Tana, you should know that we learned in a brisa, Vikulan Mesu Bechayev, and Boaz buried all of his children during his lifetime. Now, that's what Rabbi Bar Rav Huna wants to tell us, that Avtzon was Boaz, and Im Nasa Adam Isha B'Tzirusa, that if a person gets married in his youth, he should still nevertheless get married even in his older age, because it's possible, like in the case of Boaz who's Avtzon, that his children would not survive, and he would be left leaving this world childless. Therefore, he should marry even in his older age. And that's exactly what Boaz did, because Boaz is Avtzon, and he went ahead and he married Naomi even though he was older. And the Mefarshim explained, you'll see this in the Rashbam, that even though his children had not yet died, nevertheless, he should still go ahead and have an additional, in this case, one additional child. If not for Rabbi Bar Rav Huna, that Avtzon is Boaz, we would think that after the death of Avtzon's wife, he never remarried. But by identifying with Boaz, we see that even after the death of his wife, he remarried. And we would have thought that Boaz never got married before he married Ruth, but by identifying Boaz as Avtzon, we now know that he was indeed married. He had 60 children from his previous wife. Ahinu d'amri inshi, and this is what people say, b'chayech di'aladet shitim, if during your lifetime you had 60 children, but they may die during your lifetime, is shitim lamalech, what do you benefit from these 60 children that died? Ichpal v'olid chad. Do the tircha and go through the effort to find another wife and get married, and you'll have another child. The mishitin zaris, that after 60 he's still hu chazak ubari yoser me'ashish makom, that last child that he has, the 61st, might be more healthy than his previous 60. And therefore, it's important for a person to continue to having children even in his older age. Again, I'm not sure how this evolves lahalacha lamaisa, but this is the agadita here in the Gemara. So Boaz was left with nothing from his first 60 children. He married Ruth in his older years, possibly at the age of 300. And from that marriage came Oved, who is the grandfather of David HaMelech. That's what we have over here. The Rashbam is understood, but the Ein Yaakov says that the number 60 here is a remez, it's an illusion, because Chazal tell us in Brachos that Boaz didn't sleep more than 60 neshama, 60 breaths. Or others say that this is a remez to Shimshon, because Shimshon was born from Manoach, and Shimshon was Zariz Mishishim Bonim Shel Boaz, that he was even more powerful than the 60 children of Boaz. Okay, then we'll stop here, Mitzvah Shem, and we'll continue and finish Tzadi Aleph, Amid Aleph, and Amid Beis, Beli Neder, a little bit later on.